located in Lincoln Square Mall. Your dollar stays local when you shop Co-op, cultivating community and local food since 1974. And now stay tuned for today's episode of Disability Beat. This is Disability Beat, a public affairs program for and about people with disabilities. It's about social justice, community supports, inclusion, accessibility, freedom, and choice. My name is Vicki Nicewander, and I'm the host of this program and also the parent of a fantastic young woman with a disability.
The views and opinions expressed here are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT, its board of directors, associate station manager, or Prairie Air Incorporated.
Stay tuned for an interview with mental health advocate Garrett Gunter. But first, disability news for the week of January 3rd, 2022. Emma Broyles, representing the state of Alaska, was named Miss America 2022 last month in a live-streamed event after the 2021 Miss America pageant never happened because of COVID-19. Broyles received $100,000 in scholarships, increased from the last pageant in 2019, which was $50,000, as well as a six-figure salary. During her interviews, Broyles used her personal story as a strength. Said Broyles, quote, "I am real. I have flaws. I have ADHD. I have dermatillomania, or chronic skin picking," end quote. Broyles grew up in Anchorage, Alaska, and is a biomedical sciences major and aspiring dermatologist at Arizona State University. Broyles discussed during an interview how women with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder like herself are often not diagnosed at all. In a preliminary competition, Broyles won a $1,000 scholarship for her social impact initiative, Building Community Through Special Olympics. During the competition, she talked about her brother, who has Down syndrome and has competed in Special Olympics events. For the first time in 4 years, the limit on the amount of money that people with disabilities can save without risking eligibility for government benefits is increasing, at least for those who have ABLE accounts. ABLE accounts were created under a 2014 law to allow people with disabilities to save up to $100,000 without losing Social Security and other government benefits. Medicaid can be retained no matter how much is in the account. Starting this month, the Internal Revenue Service said that the federal gift tax exclusion is increasing from $15,000 to $16,000 annually. That increase is the first since 2018 and is mainly due to the recent economic inflation, according to the IRS. Interest earned on funds in ABLE accounts is tax-free, and any money saved can be used to pay for qualified expenses, including education, health care, transportation, and housing. Annual deposits in individual ABLE accounts are now limited to the value of the IRS's gift tax exclusion of $16,000 a year. People with disabilities who are employed can also save some of their earnings in the accounts above and beyond the $16,000 limit. In the continental U.S., that means up to nearly $13,000 in additional savings this year, according to the ABLE National Resource Center. Alaska residents can save an extra $16,000, and residents in Hawaii can save nearly $15,000. ABLE accounts are offered through 47 state programs, many of which are open to people with disabilities no matter where they live. As of September, ISS Market Intelligence reports that there are over 105 ABLE accounts open nationwide, containing almost $940 million in assets. To be eligible for the accounts, individuals must have a disability that onset before age 26. And finally, in a case some say could have a major impact on the rights of students with disabilities, the largest community college district in California is planning to appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court a case focused on access to textbooks, handouts, and other class materials for students who are blind. The Los Angeles Community College District Board of Trustees is arguing that federal disability rights laws don't cover unintentional discrimination, and they have announced they will ask the U.S. Supreme Court to overturn a previous ruling in favor of the students. The board is also requesting a 60-day extension in hopes of settling the case before it reaches the Supreme Court. The deadline for that extension is actually today, January 3rd. According to Board President Gabriel Buelna, quote, "We're directing our attorneys to engage immediately in negotiation to identify a constructive and mutually beneficial resolution to successfully resolve the matter. The district is committed to diversity, equity, inclusion, and access for all students, especially those with disabilities or other needs to pursue their higher education," end quote. The case stems from a 2017 lawsuit brought by two blind students who said the district did not provide academic materials such as algebra textbooks and syllabi in an audio or braille format. The result was that the students could not complete classes required to transfer to a four-year university. Some blind students had to survive years of bureaucratic delays to obtain materials in a suitable format, while others had to hire tutors to read the material aloud. Many students just gave up and dropped out, said Patricia Barbosa, an attorney representing the plaintiffs. According to Barbosa, quote, "Education is a magic bullet for people who are disabled. It allows them to get out of poverty, gain independence, move their lives forward. The whole purpose of the community college district is to offer an education to marginalized people. In this case, they did not do that," end quote. Under the Federal American with Disabilities Act, colleges, employers, and other organizations must provide the same opportunities and rights to people with disabilities as they do to those without disabilities. For blind students enrolled in college, that means classroom materials must be in Braille or a digital format that can convert to audio. One blind student tried taking algebra 4 or 5 times with no success. When the student requested an audio version of the textbook, an administrator said the textbook company wouldn't provide it because the college didn't have enough blind students to make it worthwhile. One of the well-intentioned math instructors proposed enlarging the type on handouts. The student said, who has been totally blind for 10 years, quote, "You can make it the size of a car. I still can't see it," end quote. The student, Roy Payan, finally hired a tutor to read the algebra material aloud. He passed the class, transferred to California State University in Los Angeles, earned a bachelor's degree in public administration, and is now a doctoral student at the University of Southern California studying public policy. Payan said, quote, "My hope with this lawsuit is that the district fixes the problem. Disabled students should not have to beg on their hands and knees for an education. It's too late for me, but this is for all the blind students who come after me," end quote. Claudia Center, an attorney with the Disability Rights Education and Defense Fund in Berkeley, called the district's appeal a slap in the face to the disabled community that could have broad implications for disabled people. "Most discrimination is unintentional," she said, "and without laws like the Americans with Disabilities Act, few institutions would make accommodations for people with disabilities." According to Center, quote, "We don't want the Supreme Court ruling on what kinds of discrimination are covered by the ADA. We think we have a good argument here, and we're going to defend it," end quote. William Boyer, a spokesman for the district, said the district will withdraw the appeal if the two sides can reach a resolution. And that's the news for this week. Yeah. Oh, baby, and you are tuned to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. This is Disability Beat. I'm Vicki Nicewander, and I'm joined today by Garrett Gunter, who is a mental health advocate. I heard Garrett on another program on WEFT a couple of weeks ago and was very impressed with his story and his ability to articulate all his experiences. So I'm excited to bring him as a guest for you today. Welcome to the program, Garrett.
Hey, thank you. How are you?
I'm doing well. So why don't we start out and have you introduce yourself? And you don't have to focus so much on the disability part right now, but just kind of give people a sense of who you are, what you do, what things are you passionate about, and how do you like to spend your time?
Yeah, I'm a pretty normal guy, really. I'm starting to get back into school right now. I'm going to be studying psych, which I'm really excited about. I'm a musician, so I kind of like to use that platform as much as I can to try and help others who deal with the same things that I do.
Mm-hmm.
I have a big heart for people with addiction problems, mental health problems, and really the message that I like to spread is kind of just, you know, I want to help as much as I can, but also to encourage other people to reach out and ask for help when they need it, not to be ashamed to.
Yeah, so let's talk a little bit about some of the struggles that you've had over the years. You're not old. I don't know exactly how old you are right now, but you can tell me if you want, and if you don't want to, that's fine too.
Yeah, I'm 25. I'll be 26 in February.
Yeah. So, yeah, still fairly young, but boy, you've really become quite an advocate in a short time. So talk a little bit about when you, in your life, at what age did you start thinking to yourself, or maybe it was your parents who came to the conclusion first, that maybe you were a little bit different than other kids your age?
I was really, really young when I started showing signs of, the first thing to really manifest for me was my OCD. And
for those who don't know, OCD would be what?
Obsessive compulsive disorder.
Okay. And how did that show itself?
Well, when I was really young, early elementary school, it started out as I had this need to, you know, touch things with both hands, to count my steps, even numbers. I mean, it was an obsession over these little rituals.
Mm-hmm.
And I always had this irrational fear that if I didn't follow through with this stuff, that, you know, somebody I loved was going to get hurt or die because of it. And it was definitely really consuming growing up.
Yeah, and how did that affect you when you were in school or with friends?
I definitely had trouble focusing in school. A lot of times it would kind of be at the forefront of my mind, and everything else was kind of almost like background noise, like chaos behind it.
Mm-hmm.
I remember being around my friends. I was kind of embarrassed about some of this stuff. I remember, you know, my brother would... I've got a brother who's 2 years younger than me. He's great. But he would always kind of be like, what are you doing? You know, so I knew it wasn't really normal. So I'd kind of try and hide it from my friends. And that was kind of, that took a lot of effort in itself, trying to kind of appear normal, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. And so how did that impact? I mean, did you have problems with teachers who would try to discipline you for that behavior as a result, or did you kind of cope with it fairly well in school?
Kind of a combination of both. I mean, school was really hard for me. Like I said, you know, the focusing in class,
mm-hmm.
and then when I got home, really my guitar was kind of my therapy. So that's all I wanted to do all day, because that made sense to me. You know, everything about music has always kind of just made sense to me, and it kind of fits into my frame of mind, like how I'm wired. So a lot of times, you know, getting home, instead of wanting to focus on my school and stuff, I would just be completely over it for the day. I wanted to play guitar all night and go to bed.
Mm-hmm.
So I ended up, you know, there's a lot of times I wouldn't turn in homework, and a lot of times where I was you know, sleeping through class and things like that, having trouble sleeping at home. So it definitely played a big role in having a tough time with school growing up.
And I'm sure your parents got involved when you were relatively young as well. What kind of support did they provide to you over the years?
Yeah, it was tricky because when I was really young, when it first started, when I first kind of started showing signs of this stuff, it was kind of like, you know, out of left field for my parents. I mean, they'd never really been around that. Mm-hmm. So they kind of, at first it was kind of like, well, that's not real. You know, why are you thinking like that? That's not real. What are you talking about?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the longer it went on and it didn't go away, the more my parents were kind of like, oh, okay, maybe this is something we need to deal with, you know, because it was very real for me. And I think that's frustrating for a lot of people that go through the same thing, is like, you're trying to shout from the rooftop, like, this is real, this is my reality, when, you know, to a lot of the people you talk to, it just seems just weird, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I, you know, a lot of talking, especially with my mom. I'm close with both my parents, but my mom was kind of the first one to be like, okay, well, maybe we should take him to, you know, a psychiatrist or something like that. And I did do a lot of counseling and psychiatrists and psychologists and all that good stuff growing up, which is why I'm so drawn to it, because in my eyes, I mean, it kind of really saved my life and it gave me a life worth living, you know, getting help from these people.
Yeah, I think one of the challenges, at least the little I know about OCD and depression and some of the things that accompany that, is that there is no quick fix. There's not a pill that you can take to make it better. What works for you?
Yeah, so I do take medication, and like you said, it's not a quick fix, and it's not a magic pill, you know. I mean, it helps. And I've always, you know, I encourage people to try some medication and try that kind of thing. But I do, there's a lot of coping strategies that I kind of use just throughout my daily life. I'm a really big fan of mindfulness exercises.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just when my mind starts going crazy on me, I kind of, I settle down, I focus on my breathing, and I focus, you know, on how the shirt feels on my body, how the wind feels on my face, you know, what can I smell, what can I taste, what can I hear, and a lot of times that can help me kind of step out of that chaotic frame of mind and slow down a little bit. That's a big one I use, and mm-hmm. then music for me is a huge one, music and art.
Yeah. And so when you started, how old were you when you started on medication the first time? And was it did you stay on the same thing, or was it changed over time?
Yeah, so I've been on a few different ones. I first started taking medication, I was probably third or fourth grade, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I started trying medication, and for me, what I started on, I mean, helped with my symptoms, but there, you know, different people react differently, so
right.
Some of the side effects of some medications weren't quite right for me. Some of them I had trouble sleeping on, or grinding my teeth, appetite, things like that, I think that's discouraging for a lot of people, and it was for me, too. I mean, it was very discouraging for me. I'm like, this doesn't work,
mm-hmm.
you know, and there were times where I kind of gave up on it, but I really encourage, when I'm talking to people, to just give it a chance. If it's not working for you, go back and talk to somebody and try something different. So I've probably been on, you know, four or five over the years until I found one that really works for me. So it's a process, but it's definitely worth it, in my opinion.
Yeah, I know that there are a lot of folks out there who struggle with OCD that don't reach out and get the help that they could benefit from. because of that stigma. Have you experienced the stigma that kind of goes along with OCD sometimes?
Yeah, definitely. Especially, you know, where I live, I'm not saying anything bad about where I live. I live in a small town, and mm-hmm. it's kind of, you know, the manly man macho thing. And it's hard to reach out and say, you know, hey, I'm depressed, or like I feel really anxious, and these kind of things are kind of it did deter me a little bit as far as just not wanting to sound weak, and things like that. But you know, like I've talked about before, I've learned to not view it any differently than physical illness. I mean, I'm sure some people are, but generally people aren't embarrassed to say, you know, hey, I've got diabetes, or I got, you know, a heart problem or something like that. And I think we as society should really work towards kind of trying to classify these things in the same boat, so people aren't scared to make the effort to get better.
Yeah, I think it's kind of, you know, the brain is a mysterious thing to most doctors, right? They don't really know how it works. But I think you're right, looking at it as a medical issue, and, you know, we have to deal with this as we would any other condition, is an important thing to convey to the community, because people do look at it as, well, I don't understand what it is, therefore it's weird, or this person is strange because they have this condition. And that's something that I think lots of people with mental health issues deal with for their lives, because they feel like they have to hide it from others. Have you ever, you don't sound like the type of person who tries to hide that kind of stuff.
Yeah, no, not anymore, because I have been before, you know, mm-hmm. and I've learned that me not hiding it maybe might help someone else to say, like, hey, this guy's not embarrassed, you know, why should I be? Mm-hmm. And, you know, when I think that's what's so important to me about being open about these things is I just would really like to create some sort of change where more people are willing to be open about it. Because at the end of the day, like you said, you know, the brain is mysterious. I mean, I kind of think of the brain to the body as the ocean is to the earth. You know, mm-hmm. we don't know everything there is to know about the ocean. And it's kind of one of those things. If you can't see it in an x-ray machine or a CAT scan or whatever, these chemical imbalances and things that people are dealing with, you have to speak up and be honest about your symptoms and be honest what you go through every day. It's hard to deal with unmanaged symptoms.
Yeah.
I mean, it can be really hard.
I can imagine. Fortunately, I don't have that issue, at least not on a regular basis. So I know that there are a lot of people out there who kind of struggle silently without a lot of support. Do you know other people with OCD that you connect with on a regular basis? Is there a group or an organization out there that people should know about?
You know, that I'm not 100% sure about, to be honest with you. Mm-hmm. That would probably be a good thing maybe for me to look into at some point. I do have a family member that has gone through it really similar to me. I mean, it manifests itself differently in certain people, different people.
Mm-hmm.
And his has always been really similar to mine. So we relate on that level. But yeah, that definitely is a cool idea.
Well, I could see you being a very valuable member of a group like that, because you are so well able to articulate, you know, your thoughts and feelings and experiences that could be so important for somebody else to hear. Because I know that a lot of folks with disabilities often think that they're so alone in the world, that there's nobody else that has experienced these kinds of effects that you have described.
Yeah, it is. It is easy to feel that way, to feel just out of place. I mean, growing up, I've always been pretty personable and get along with people, but I never felt like I fit into a certain group, you know, and I've kind of found just through friends and family that kind of go through the same things that seems to be pretty common with people that struggle with these same issues, is just kind of feeling a little bit out of place, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. So if you were going to, you know, speak to people in the community, which is essentially what you're doing right now, what are the things that people who aren't familiar with OCD, depression, anxiety, and all the symptoms that people deal with that are mental health challenges, what do they need to know about that, about people who have those conditions?
I think it's really important for people to understand that it's very real. It's not necessarily like an emotional thing, you know. I mean, it connects to, it affects your emotions, but it's not, deep down, it's, you know, chemical imbalance or things like that, that we can't help it, you know. And it's, I think society's getting better at seeing these types of things, but I think there's still a lot of people that just kind of have that, well, like, suck it up and move on type attitude. And for me, I think it's just important for people to listen, you know, and just understand that it's a real thing. I mean, people give up and lose their lives every day in their own life, you know, and I think that's another thing that's really looked over in our society is suicide, and it's more common than most people want to admit.
Yeah, I've heard that too, and thank goodness you found ways to cope that don't lead you in that direction, and your medication is helping in that too, I'm sure. But it sounds to me like music is the thing that really has kept you on an even keel. What kind of music do you like? What do you play?
I'm in a rock band, mm-hmm, called Ancient Ways. We play around here, and then but I also, I love all kinds of music. I mean, I love blues and a little bit of hip hop and stuff. And I'm really, really all over the place, folk and old country. And, you know, it's always really, music always has spoken to me in a big way.
Mm-hmm.
I really love it all.
Yeah. So psychology, yeah, it's an interest, definitely. Sounds like music might be a good sidebar for you.
Yeah, definitely. I'll definitely play music as long as I'm able, and if I don't lose my hearing from playing it, I'll listen as long as I'm able to.
Hopefully not. I know that can be a danger for sure. So, is right? there anything we didn't talk about that you'd like people to understand about you or your disability, or, you know, whatever you think is important for them to hear?
I think, you know, my biggest thing is just, if there's anybody out there that's just scared to reach out, or, you know, scared to, just that stigma, just, you know, I think it's important for people to get past that stigma. And, mm-hmm, and for me, I've gotten to the point that, you know, if people think I'm an emotional guy or whatever, I don't really care. You know, I'm making my life livable. And for those people that feel like there's no way out and that life is just always going to be this miserable trudging along day to day, it doesn't have to be. And I think it's important for people to, I know it's cheesy, but I always say there's a light at the end of the tunnel, mm-hmm, you know? And I think it's really important for people in those really dark times just to realize that life can be better.
Yeah, well, I hope you're able to find a way to get connected to other people and share that message, because I think it's really important and you speak it so well. So we're out of time. I want to thank you for joining me today, Garrett Gunter, mental health advocate. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
This and other episodes of Disability Beat are available at weft.org/public affairs. For updates and information, join our Facebook page at Disability Beat Radio. To share ideas for guests or topics, email Vicki at disabilitybeat@gmail.com. Thanks for tuning in, and have a great rest of your week. No, I'm staying.